Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Our topic today is our failed mental health industry. My guest, currently in Hawaii, is Jim Gottstein. That's G-O-T-T-S-T-E-I-N. He's an attorney in Alaska with a law degree from Harvard Law School, and he's been representing and advocating for sane psychiatric treatment for individuals diagnosed with a mental illness. In 2002, he founded the Law Project for Psychiatric Rights in order to mount a strategic litigation campaign against forced psychiatric drugging and electroshock therapy. The project is committed to informing the public about the counterproductive and harmful effects of conventional psychiatric treatments. He is also the author of the book, The Zyprexa Papers, which recounts the story and firsthand account of corruption about one of the most prescribed psychiatric drugs for mental disorders. The drug's maker, Eli Lilly, intentionally concealed that its top-selling drug caused diabetes and other life-shortening metabolic conditions. It also illegally promoted Zyprexa on children and the elderly. Upon receipt of documents, Eli Lilly threatened Jim with criminal contempt charges. More about the Zyprexa papers can be found at thezyprexapapers.com, and the website for the Law Project is psychrights.org. Nice to have you with us today, Jim.
Thanks for having me.
Jim, with the current pandemic and the rush for drugs and vaccines, I believe we're witnessing the pharmaceutical industry's power over our lives, especially its influence over decisions being made by our federal health officials. The public is increasingly becoming aware of both the influence of Big Pharma, but also its corruption and the cost of lives due to adverse drug reactions that are often either covered up or not communicated honestly to patients or doctors. We all remember, or should, the corruption of Merck to keep Vioxx on the market by concealing the drug's lethal risks. Yet the same is true of the entire psychiatric profession, which I believe is based upon a biological model of mental disorders that we're told can only be treated by medications. Now, mental disorders, whether fact or fiction, and I believe they're fiction, plague the U.S. today. Very conservatively, we're told that about 10% of children have ADHD. I believe the figure is actually much higher given the number of school kids on antidepressant anxiety medications. One antipsychotic drug you've investigated in depth is Zyprexa, which is prescribed for manic episodes and bipolar disorders and schizophrenia. It is another story of the pharmaceutical industry's cover-up of serious adverse effects in order to increase profits. So please begin by what you have uncovered about Zyprexa, how widely it is prescribed, and what are its more serious risks, and then share the evidence you produce showing this is another case of corporate malfeasance that put patients unnecessarily at risk. The forum is yours.
Well, thank you, Gary. Zyprexa, what I discovered was, and it was really Dr. Grace Jackson's report that she gave for a legal case I did, was that basically from the very beginning, Lilly, you know, kind of cooked the books or basically conducted fraudulent studies. So, for example, one of the things that they did to try and get approval was they withdrew patients for the placebo group. They withdrew patients from Haldol abruptly, which we know causes people to become psychotic just from the withdrawal effect. And they use that as the comparison group to make the placebo group worse than Zyprexa. They called, not only that, while a lot of people become psychotic from the withdrawal, not from any underlying so-called mental illness, but from the withdrawal, some people actually do quite well. And what Lilly did is they threw them out of this study, and they called this placebo washout. So that was one of the fraudulent ways that they conducted the studies. Another was what they called last observation carried forward, where Zyprexa is basically intolerable for a pretty large number of people, and that's why so many people have to be forced to take it. They don't want to take it, and so the psychiatrists get court orders to force people to take it. So, but in this study, people were allowed to withdraw, to quit it, because they weren't under any compulsion. And a large number withdrew from the study, over 50%. And so what Lilly did is they said, we're going to assume that these patients who withdrew because the drug effects were so terrible, or that the patients didn't feel that it helped them, we're just going to assume that the condition they were in when they withdrew is the condition they would be in at the end of the study. Excuse me. So what's the point of doing a study if you're just going to assume that nothing's going to change? So that was another fraudulent part of the study. Now, in terms of the Zyprexa papers themselves, which this expert witness in this massive litigation against Eli Lilly over it causing diabetes and other metabolic problems, I was enjoined by the, and I'm still subject to an injunction, which means prohibited from further disseminating the documents, and I had to return them all. So I only know mostly about what's in them from the New York Times stories, which basically revealed that Lilly hid from doctors the diabetes and other metabolic problems, and the illegal marketing to children and the elderly.
Okay, let's go through what you consider legitimate or illegitimate science involving this brain chemical imbalance theory, which is the basis of almost all psychiatry. I don't care what condition you walk into a psychiatrist's office with, whatever your symptoms, within a relatively short period of time, based upon our research, under 7 minutes, you will be diagnosed with a mental condition that is based upon a brain chemical imbalance and given a prescription. And none of that is based upon actual double-blind clinical controlled studies.
Yes, that's correct. And in fact, I mean, basically, the psychiatric industry has no evidence of any kind of physical defect in the brain or any other kind of biological condition that causes what's diagnosed as mental illness. What they say is, well, we've been looking for it for 100 years, but we haven't found it yet, but we're sure we will. And they haven't. And what's pretty clear is that for almost all people, I mean, this is from my own experience in talking to people, is most people feel that something happened to them early in their life, in their childhood or something, that set them up for problems. And then something happened recently to kind of push them over the edge. Now, this I'm talking about serious, people, what you would call, what I like to call going crazy, and what the mental illness industry calls becoming psychotic. And so it's pretty clear that most everything that gets diagnosed with as mental illness is really reactions to events in people's lives and adaptations. So one of the kind of extreme examples, I think, that maybe illustrates the point is multiple personality disorder. I'm kind of forgetting what the current diagnosis of it is. But what we find with people that have that condition is that as young children, they were seriously abused physically and maybe sexually. And so what they did as a way to adapt to that was they withdrew into a different part of their mind. So that abuse was happening to someone else. They didn't experience it as happening to them. They experienced it as happening to someone else. And so that's really quite a good adaptation response to this kind of abuse. And then what happens as they further develop, they instead of, we might have, different, ways of reacting in different conditions, they would develop totally different personalities in different situations. And when the different personalities don't know what the other personalities are doing, then it becomes a really chaotic life. But this is, I think, kind of an illustration of the process that goes on that's really usually an adaptive process to something that's happening in one's life. And that's for the, for the more serious conditions that get diagnosed as mental illness. Now, other things like depression, what gets diagnosed as depression, it's just sadness. And one of the things that you find is that most people will resolve that within a matter of weeks, which just happens to be the amount of time that they say you need to be on the drugs. And then the drugs are really a trap because you get addicted to them, and then they become very problematic.
I appreciate that answer. Thank you. If companies can sell a drug over and beyond the original disorders for their approval, they will do so. The more indications a drug can be marketed for and push on doctors, the greater the rewards financially. And sales reps today are in fact trained to do this, despite the complete lack of any quality science that the medication can treat an illness. This is truly, in my opinion, criminal, yet companies are doing it all the time. If they get caught and settle a fine out of court, it is simply the cost of doing business. Besides, the price markup of drug cost is astronomical compared to the actual manufacturing of a 30-day generic supply. In fact, we did some research on this, and thanks to Life Extension's and Bill Falloon's coverage of this, we found that some drugs, especially the psychiatric drugs, can be 5 to 100,000% at retail versus what it actually costs the manufacturers to produce. How was Eli Lilly involved in this racket, and how widespread is it with other psychiatric drugs on the market now?
Well, it's one of the it's just pervasive in the industry. Now, in the United States, doctors, as I think you indicated, are allowed to prescribe drugs for any use, but the drug companies are not allowed to promote it for any uses except that as are approved by the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA. And, as I discussed before, those approvals are even pretty suspect in themselves. So one of the interesting things that PsychRights came up with is that while the doctors can prescribe off-label, which is what prescribing for use that's not approved by the FDA is called, under Medicaid and Medicare, they're not allowed to pay for those drugs if they're off-label unless there's scientific support for it in these medical compendia and drug compendia. So there's a federal law called the False Claims Act, also known as QI-TAM or whistleblower cases, where people can sue on behalf of the federal government for fraud. And each false claim carries a minimum penalty of $5,500. And each prescription is a false claim. And so the off-label prescription of psychiatric drugs for children is just horrendous. I mean, they're prescribing a drug similar to Zyprexa, Seroquel, for sleep. And this is a drug that causes brain damage and really dramatically worsens, you know, people's prospects. And it's especially bad in foster children. So the idea is we developed a model complaint where someone can sue on behalf of the federal government for this. And each, any prescriber worth their salt would have prescribed, say, 1,000 of these in the 6-year statute of limitations. So that's, that's $5.5 million. And the idea was to try and tag one or more of these psychiatrists with one of these and hopefully bankrupt them and scare the dickens out of the other psychiatrists. And we won one case in the on appeal in the Seventh Circuit, but it got messed up in when it went back down to the trial court. So that's one approach to try and through litigation to try and deal with this off-label prescribing.
What do you think about Eli Lilly retaliating against you by charging you with criminal intent?
It, it was certainly scary for me. I mean, one of the things that I write about in the book is that my client, Bill Bigley, had a guardian, and the hospital wouldn't let him sign an authorization for release of information. So when I was hauled into court a month after the New York Times articles came out, I couldn't testify that he had been actually given Zyprexa. I was pretty sure that he had, and I thought I had testified to that effect, but I'd scoured the transcript and it's just not there. Well, I found out shortly after the judge's decision that I got the records. And in fact, Bill had been forcibly drugged with Zyprexa within a week of me issuing the subpoena. And then about a month later, he was forcibly drugged with Zyprexa. So by the time they got to, really thinking about criminal contempt, they knew that the story was quite a bit different than what the judge had said in the civil case, where he said that the subpoena was a sham and I had conspired to steal these documents, when in fact what we did was follow the secrecy order to the letter, which required that Lilly be given notice of any such subpoena and a reasonable opportunity to object.
Let's pull it back a little further and look at all of psychiatry. It has managed to insinuate itself through the legal profession of being the final arbiter of what a person's state of mind is, and they can forcibly retain a person, they can restrain a person, they can drug a person. In effect, they can do pretty much what they want with very little recourse. And I have not seen yet any major expose in the mainstream media about psychiatry itself. They might focus upon one treatment or the excessive drugging of children in foster care or using those children for some form of vaccine experiments. They have done this on a regular basis. But not looking in at the field and saying, is this real medical science? And that is a big problem, at least from my perspective, because when we went out to film all the different people we could, in the Columbine Massacre, for a documentary I did called The Drugging of Our Children, they all said that Eric Harris and the other shooter were normal until he got an increase in his prescription, I believe it was Zyprexa and another of Prozac. And then they started going into this very psychotic, paranoid, and violent state of mind. And yet, no one in the media that I'm aware of has pointed out the fact that at least 95% of all mass killings in the last 40 years have been with people who were on antipsychotic or antidepressant medications. We have about 20 to 22 veterans every 24 hours killing themselves, more often than not putting a gun in their mouth and blowing their brains out. They get on these drugs while they're in a combat zone, Iraq, Afghanistan, wherever it may be, and we don't get them off. They're supposed to be on these for life, and no one should be on any drug for life, and yet they are. And yet the Veterans Administration, the White House, the Defense Department, the Pentagon, no one has taken any responsibility for all these vets killing themselves. So we added up how many vets have actually died, and it's over 160,000. That means you're up there with total American casualties in World War I and twice the amount of casualties in the Vietnam War. And yet none of these casualties occurred in combat, meaning when a person's home, they kill themselves. Yet no blame to the pharmaceutical industry, the scientists sitting on these advisory panels at the FDA and CDC. And the same is true for all the kids committing suicide. No one is blaming the pharmaceutical company or the drugs for the number one cause of death, suicide between 10 and 14-year-old boys. When I was growing up, possibly when you were growing up, you never had a young boy commit suicide. Today, it's a major killer. So when you pull back far enough, you see that we don't want to know the truth about Columbine. In fact, Bowling for Columbine, Michael Moore's a film came out, and I watched his film, but then I invited Michael to look at the film footage we found, and it showed that it wasn't the rifles or availability of weapons that caused this massacre. It was the drugs. And so here we had all these people saying that Michael betrayed them and misrepresented himself in the film. So Michael came in and actually sat down, and we filmed him where he acknowledged it was not the guns, it was the drugs, medications were on. He reached out and took a slug at some of these pharmaceutical companies. Yet you've had nothing in the way the mainstream media, not 60 Minutes, not 2020, not Dateline, none of these programs exposing the pharmaceutical industry, the practice of medicine itself, as being the underlying cause of so much human suffering. Your thoughts, please.
Well, sad to say, I think that a big part of it is how much drug advertising revenues the media gets. Because there are a lot of people, such as yourself and others, you know, Peter Breggin, Dr. Peter Breggin, and the International Society for Ethical Psychology and Psychiatry, have really brought this information to the attention of the mainstream media, and it just doesn't get any traction. And it's pretty hard to conclude that it's anything other than the amount of money that the pharmaceutical spends on drug advertising. And, you know, the U.S. is only one of two countries that allows direct-to-consumer advertising, and the other one is New Zealand. And I think this has been a huge folly and caused just a huge amount of, people taking way more drugs than they should.
Well, I think any drug that a person takes for a mental condition instead of first working with them on a more humanistic level is wrong. One of my early friends when I was very young, just in New York City, and I met him through another friend, was Dr. Lawrence Lashan. I don't know if you've ever heard of him, but he was one of the major psychologists in the United States. He was up there with Rollo May, Eric Fromm, you know, that on that level. And he was the one who got me my appointment as a junior scientist at the Institute of Applied Biology, where he also did his research. And he said to me, and this was a classic study he did, he did in-depth interviews with 500 women who had no history of cancer in their family, and based upon what they felt about themselves, did they feel appreciated, did they feel loved, he could predict with a high degree of accuracy would they develop breast cancer. And then he did other studies. And then Gerald Kessler, who was head of psychiatry department of City of New York, followed up on those studies. And I knew Gerald, we had some conversations over at the Institute. He said that almost every problem begins with a lack of honest perception that then alters our reality. So you have to find out where the trauma, where the problem originated, and go there and work with that person on understanding that you were young, you couldn't control the circumstances, and now you're aware of it. Let's see if we can have a life lesson so you don't keep blaming yourself or getting into these moods, which have nothing to do with brain chemical imbalances, but have to do with life circumstances that we all face. And he had enormous success. In fact, there was a whole group of psychologists from Columbia University, Elaine Kahn, Dr. Martin Shepard, Dr. Carmi Arari, Dr. Alan Putterman. I knew all these people. In fact, three of the four I just mentioned, plus Dr. Albert Ellis at the Ellis Center and Dr. Donald Mullen, who was one of its chief psychologists, these were my personal friends. And they didn't rely upon a psychiatric model and a pharmaceutical model. They relied upon good old-fashioned talk therapy and exercise and cleaning up their diet with great results, better than any drug. And they were appalled by how easy it was to convert most psychologists and therapists into the biological model, including electroconvulsive therapy for depression. When you look back at all this and you see now that electroconvulsive therapy is making a comeback, how do you feel about that?
Well, it's just a tragedy. There was all this great work that was being done up maybe through the 1970s about how to really help people get through what Dr. Thomas Oz called problems in living. And it just got overwhelmed with this biomedical model, which is, as I said, just there's no evidence for. And so what you say about talk therapy being really helpful is good. And one of the people that was working in this area, Jay Haley, Dr. Jay Haley, is a psychologist, maybe social worker. He also came up with this idea that a lot of times it's the relationship. So, for example, in a family dynamic, oftentimes, family dynamics are problematic, and the child will kind of sacrifice themselves to try and save the family. And working with the family, he had huge success. And there is a program that was started in Finland called the Open Dialogue Approach, where they try and avoid, they avoid giving people drugs. And they consider that the problem is, in the spaces between people, and they bring everybody in. They never exclude the, quote, identified patient, and they talk things through. And they get, for people that have become psychotic or go crazy, they have an 80% recovery rate, 80%. And so in the United States, where we have, drugs for everyone, forever, of course, approach, only 5% recover. And there was a naturalistic study done by Dr. Harrow and Dr. Job that followed people for 15 years after they had been put on the neuroleptics for a period of time and got off of them. And they found that people who had been put on the drugs, who'd been on the drugs for a while and got off of them, 40% recovered. And if they stayed on them, they 5% recovered. That's where I got to 5%. And so what you see is that once people have been put on these drugs for any length of time, the prospect for recovery goes from 80% to 40%, even if they get off of them. So that really shows how important it is to really avoid putting people on these drugs in the first place. And there was a study by Dr. Lauren Moser, who was chief of schizophrenia research at the National Institute of Mental Health in the 1970s, called the Soteria House, where they had a similar approach. And I would describe, or he described it as being with people rather than doing to them. And they also had an 80% recovery rate. And so what we've done is taken situations that people could get through and get on with their lives and turn them into permanent mental patients, disabled mental patients. And it's on a massive scale. The percentage of people on disability because of a diagnosis, you know, where the disability is attributed to mental illness, has gone up 600%, six times since the introduction of the so-called miracle drug Thorazine in the mid-1950s. And most of this is attributable to the psychiatric drugs, and especially what they're doing now, which is multiple drugs at the same time. I mean, I've seen people that were on 12 of these drugs at the same time, and 2 and 3 and 4 is really quite common. And these haven't even been studied.
Jim, thank you very much for being on today and sharing these important insights. You're a good attorney. You're fighting for the rights of people, and I appreciate it.
You bet. I'm pleased to be here. Thank you very much.
Jim Gottstein, attorney, and his two sites are the Law Project for Psychiatric Rights is psychrights.org, and you can also find Zyprexa Papers at zyprexapapers.com. Zyprexa, Zyprexa, papers.com. Now, for the next half of our program, I'm going to show you what is possible when you look for positive insights into the choices we make and the lessons we can learn from the mistakes we make. So instead of beating up on ourselves or shaming ourselves or allow others to shame ourselves or living within an inconclusive idea of our presence, our insecurities and uncertainties, we can actually be optimistic. And I've helped a lot of people overcome psychiatric disorders when they take this approach. In fact, we did a clinical study, the only clinical study of its kind. 500 people were in it. And we met every week for 3 months. You had to have clinical depression, be under treatment, be on medications before you started. At the end, 94% of the people were no longer considered or diagnosed as clinically depressed or anxious or on anxiety medication. Their doctors took them off their meds, and they were happy, healthy people. Yet not a word of this anywhere, like it didn't happen. But it did. This is one of 44 clinical studies I've done. So now we're going to take a brief break, come right back at you with a several part of a very important series on understanding the outcome of the choices we make. Please stay with us.
Hi, I'd like to welcome you to a special presentation, one that is a part of our Mastering Life series. This series started over 13 years ago, and over 100 programs have been done in it up to this point. With each one, I try to give different insights of the human condition. The information is meant just as a guide, asking questions, probing assumptions, challenging many of our beliefs, with the hope that at the end of this, you'll be able to look at life a little differently and hopefully be empowered. Today, our discussion is going to focus upon something I feel is very important. It is called mastering our opposite. Now, what do I mean? Let me give you an example. Let's say that you're an individual who has worked very hard at your career. Maybe you're an artist. a writer, a painter, a graphic artist, a sculptor, a dancer, a poet. But at your heart, you feel that you have a life of value beyond just being a mechanic of what you do. That the mechanism is merely a way of getting something accomplished. Even the intellectual mechanism is just to get something out and look at it. When you go into a kitchen and you see a chef that has all their ingredients laid out, you don't know what it's going to look like, how it's going to taste. In fact, it's rather surprising to see wonderful dishes at the end of this process. What we make the mistake of doing more often than not is we judge the ingredients at any given time based upon our fears or expectations of what that final product is supposed to be. So what if I'm afraid to fail? What if I'm afraid to create something that's really unique, away from the recipe? Just let my mind go and say, I'm going to put it together, and it's going to taste great. And I have the confidence to be present for that experience. That's not what we do. What we do is we try to master each of the ingredients and how we should feel about them. In effect, we take one piece of an ingredient of life and we become expert at it. Everyone masters something. I've never met a person who didn't. It's not about education. It's not about finances, social position. It's about, in a world that only respects you if you have established yourself, then what it is that you're going to establish yourself will become an extension of who you are. So now we have a person who wakes up one day and they've created something. They've taken the time and the effort and the energy and the skills to create something. So now they look at their work and they question it. Is it as good as it could be? Is it not as good? How do I know that people like it or not like it? Maybe it's hard to get started. And now what happens is almost everything necessary to feel good about what they've done, they actually feel bad about it. They actually question themselves. Instead of having jubilation and joy in their experience, they have hesitation. There's a fear that something's wrong. There's not an authentic connection, and there should be. As hard as people work, the problem is that people have mastered their opposite. So doing more of what you've done won't change anything, and yet that's exactly what we do. Even people who are caregivers try to give more. Well, there's only so much you can give, and then there's nothing left to give. People who in a relationship give more, attention and time and love and affection, adoration, and then one day they wake up and they still feel nothing authentic. There's not that essential connection. You can only connect with something when it's authentically you and not your opposite. If it's your opposite, it's dualistic. The trouble is we frequently misinterpret what is dualism. We'll say, well, the dualistic of good is bad. But what if we don't see the world that way? What if we have disguised our opposite? We've only mastered part of what we should and not the totality. Then what has happened is we've taken of 100 ingredients that should go into a recipe, we've taken one or two. We've mastered those two. We know everything about those one or two. What are you going to make with one or two? It's never going to be complete. In your mind, it's going to be complete because you're visualized, fantasizing something that you're not creating in reality. All of you have had expectations far beyond the reality of what you've created, right? You've wanted something, whether it's in a relationship or a job or in someone else. You've projected an ideal. Why do you think people project ideals? Because by projecting an ideal, you're protecting the fallibility of the non-ideal. You're protecting what you've mastered. You've mastered the non-ideal. So you think about the ideal. Now think of that for a moment. Do you understand what I just said? When we focus upon doing something because of how we're going to be received, perceived, judged, evaluated, then all of our energy is in mastering the defense mechanism that allows people to see exactly what they want, we want them to see about us. But also, it has its opposite end. We master what we don't want people to see about us, what we don't want people to know about us. That's mastery. You never tell anybody everything about yourself, do you? Because think of all the things you think about that you feel people would not accept or not understand or would fear. So then, the opposite of what we want, fulfillment and connecting with something that gives us a sense of belonging, being, has not been mastered. Instead, what we've mastered is a partial self. Here's the good part of me. Here's the part of optimism. Here's the part of jubilance. Here's the part of the wonderful poet, the wonderful artist, the wonderful homemaker, the wonderful lover, the wonderful healer, the wonderful caregiver, the wonderful naturalist, the wonderful idealist. Oh, people gravitate to that. Now, you see people like that. You see people are connected to it. So what do? You master it. All your energy goes into defending it. And the more fearful you are of surrendering what you've mastered, the greater reaction to anything that challenges it. Reaction is a direct relationship to the fear that you have of full discovery. Do you understand what that means? Yes? No? Okay, anyone not understand what that means? All right, let me be a little clearer. Let's say that we want people to know us, identify us for what we believe is the most important quality about us, so we really work on that. And then one day we wake up and people have accepted us for that, and we think, wow, you know, they like me for something. We also know that the things in our mind, things in our heart, things in our psyche, that we know people wouldn't like us the same way. So what do we do with that? We can't just let that come out. So what do? We hide it. When you hide something, you have to remember where you hid it. Right? You don't want it suddenly opening up in a closet and someone saying, oh, let's look in your psyche. Whoa! That's an ugly thing. I don't want that. And then we have to, no, that's not me. You didn't see me in there. And then we start the excuses. Then we get clever enough because we're so good at mastering the limitation of ourselves that we stand psychically in front of anything that causes it to change. Why do you think so many people are overweight and then crash, diet, and go right back up? Why do you think so many people think higher ideals than what they actualize on? Why do you think so many people have ideas of being whole and complete and fulfilled and dynamic and love and lovable, and you don't connect with it? And then they work harder at it. The game is mastering working harder for a preferential treatment of yourself and in the eyes of other people. Look, he's working really hard. Give him a break. I mean, look, my God, I mean, she's going to therapy and she's working on herself and she cries a lot and he's, you know, he's doing all he can, and we suddenly we're led astray. Because we're thinking that a person's efforts mean they really want to change. No! It's a game. The opposite would be to change. So that's why you can spend years in this wasteland of trying to be someone that you're not. But you have been who you needed to be, and that's what you mastered. You mastered defenses. You mastered exits, what I call the exits of life. How's this work? It works this way. The moment you commit yourself to anything, that means you have to use everything, where you must embrace your fear and be present with it and realize it's not real. You must embrace your limitations and realize it's you alone that should judge that and no one else. You embrace your insecurity and realize the insecurity is a myth, populating people's minds based upon what the preconceived notion of what you can and cannot do. Well, I'm black. I'm old. I'm a woman. I'm Puerto Rican. I'm poor. I'm uneducated. Think of all the excuses that people have used as a rationale for feeling that this is why I'm not what? Not loved, not respected. And then one day, enough people believe in something, and then it becomes a truth. And then behind that truth, we hide the dysfunctional self, the hidden self. Behind this and stereotypes, behind these cute little things become our exits. So for every step we take forward in life with a challenge, we also have one eye forward on the challenge. Look where we're going, gonna do it this time, gonna work hard. And over here to the left is the exit. But how can you go forward and out at the same time? How can you do it? You can't. You can't be at two places simultaneously with the same energy. But we deceive ourselves. And that's why we're so confused. Because we think that the effort we put in, including the emotional effort, the emotions themselves, emoting doesn't change anything, does it? Cry a river of tears over a problem, and what happens to the problem? Nothing. Be afraid of a problem, what happens? Nothing. Fear disempowers. Uncertainty disempowers. And mastering the wrong side of what you need disempowers. So more of the same. Changing partners, changing careers, changing locations, changing anything doesn't change you. There's never a circumstance more significant than your life. And yet we try to make circumstances our life. Well, if only, you know, if only what? Well, if only she would have loved me, if he would have loved me, if I would have had, if I would have made, if they would have bought, if I would have got. That's an excuse. And because those excuses become the exit. So when you don't get this you're going forward to, that you've announced, that everybody's aware of, then you got this. And that was there all along. And that becomes our escape mechanism. So when you escape, the escape is actually intentional, it's methodical, it's premeditated, and it's built into the psyche. Even if you think it's unconscious, there are no unconscious acts. When people say, you know, I wasn't focused. Oh, yes, you were. You're just on the wrong thing. I wasn't conscious. Yes, you were. But unconscious on the wrong thing. Think when you don't do something. Think when you lose something. It's because your mind was on something else, not what you were supposed to be focused on. So do we actually say, what can I learn from that? No. Instead, we go ahead and do it again and get angry with ourselves or someone else. Then suddenly circumstances become what bothers us. So I'm suggesting that when you wake up one day and realize that you simply have feared the wrong things, you have feared surrendering completely the limited or dysfunctional self, the imperfect self, but everything in life is imperfect. When you get close enough to it, you see the imperfections. But unfortunately, we can't convince ourselves or others that life is imperfect because everyone is judging someone based upon an imperfect value. Just look at what happens when you're 30 and you're judged at one level, and you're 40 in a different level, and 50 a different level. Three people walking in to get a job, all equally qualified, I can assure you that the 60-year-old or 70-year-old will be the ones first to be disqualified because of their age. It shouldn't be that way. And then you're disqualified based upon how you look. Then you're disqualified based upon all the other limitations that someone has mastered. Racism has to be mastered. Doesn't come naturally. Bias has to be mastered. Bigotry has to be mastered. Prejudice has to be mastered. Fear has to be mastered. You can't be afraid until you've mastered it. You can't be dysfunctional until you've mastered it. And one day you wake up and you are a master of it. Now realize there's a consequence that when you've mastered any limiting factor, when you've mastered it, its opposite has to be surrendered. You can't master both. So we're all masters of frequently the wrong energy. Our primal chi is our life force. When we're in balance, it flows. Life is harmonizing. All of our chakras are in rhythm and harmony. We feel good. We feel at ease. We feel that the world around us and our energy are moving at the same level. We can heal with that energy. We can bring in other people's energy. We can connect authentically. And authentic connections mean there's no impediment, there's no barrier. And when you connect with something that's authentic, you feel it. Remember, anything you're working hard on, you're working on the wrong energy. So I know the moment someone says, but I'm working so hard, then they haven't surrendered their opposite. When you're connecting, it is fluid. You're at ease. Being honest should be at ease. Well, if you're not honest, then you're dishonest. Dishonesty requires mastery. And what we do, we are disingenuous because we only show what we feel confident can be accepted in a politically talking system, politically correct talking system, but what we really feel we have to hide. Go back to what I said, we're going to hide anything that will cause it to be judged in the wrong way or harshly. So once again, we can't be honest. We can't say, well, here's what I really think. Here's what I really believe. Here's what I really want to do. Because if we did that, someone says, hold on a second. We can't accept that. And then we think, okay, what is going to happen now? Am I going to be judged? Will I be thrown out? Will I be excluded? The human condition craves connection. Now take a careful look at what you've connected with and ask yourself, is it real or is it part of your dysfunction? Does it honor you and liberate you or does it condition you? Anything that you have not yet mastered requires patience and compassion. The nice thing about causing choices that end up in disasters, of many or major disasters, is that we can actually benefit from that. If we realize that that disaster, by doing something wrong, is a wonderful lesson. Now, you either actively seek the lessons in life, and that requires discipline. To seek a lesson, you must close all exits. Board them up. But you haven't done that. You're always looking for that exit. And one way to get the exit is to get other people to agree with you. So confession, declaration, betrayal of our fear. That's why people betray. They're actually betraying fear. But what if you said, there's no option? Exit's not an option. Compromise is not an option. I'm going to do this until I do it right. I'm going to work on myself until I get it right. And if I have to go through pain, I will embrace the pain and I'll be present for it. Do you know what it means when something bad happens to you and instead of reacting, instead of getting angry, instead of looking for the exit, you simply stop and you go silent and you're simply present in that moment with what you're experiencing. Just present. When you're simply present, then a language, deeper, more meaningful than a verbal message, communicates with you. In that silence of just being present, the universal energy comes in. The chi brings that energy in, and you have all that energy to work from. And now you can look at those problems in a proper perspective because you're not emotionally attached to the outcome. When you detach the ego from the outcome, then the outcome no longer is something to be alien to you or feared. You're simply aware of what you're doing. Right now, people are in unhappy relationships more often than not and afraid to commit themselves to a true relationship of an authentic connection because they have not mastered the art of being honest to themselves. So they bump from one to another or get stuck in something that is a compromise. So what we do, we adapt to laying on a bed of nails and anesthetize the pain by our distractions. And we think as long as I master something that feels good in my life, I can tolerate the pain of everything that doesn't. And then think about what you master that takes away the pain from what you have not. And that shows you where most people are. And that's why we are sublimating all the time. You wouldn't have a nation of people who gamble and smoke and drink and overwork and complain and whine and moan and blame unless it was pure sublimation of what is not authentic in their life. So that's what we should be looking at, not the end stage of it, not a psychosis or neuroses, not obesity or heart disease or cancer. That's the very end stage of the mastery of your opposite that has a negative consequence. Master the wrong energy, you're going to have all negative consequences. Even though along the way, you may think that you've gotten positive results, because almost anything that you work hard at initially, you will get a result that someone will acknowledge. Well, if that were the case that all we have to do is have hard work, then everybody who's a hard worker would be happy. Isn't the case. Everyone who's successful financially or in their careers. But that's not true either. The difference is, think how much those people who are successful at doing something have hidden from themselves and others what they don't want the world to see. Full revelation always is shocking to us. Why should it be? Why should it be shocking when we find out something about someone that we didn't want them to be, like a hero? Oh, we find out they're really human. Well, it's their fault maybe for not allowing us to see how human they were, and it's our fault for projecting upon someone else the ideals that we're not willing to manifest in ourselves. Always be careful around people who need you to be a hero, because it means that they're going to blame you for not being a hero. You're their standard instead of them being their own standard. So how can we disengage from one energy and master what allows us the freedom to be? Well, first you have to go back in your history. Go back to when you were a little boy or a little girl. What did all little boys and little girls have in common? Huh? Well, for those of you who actually were little boys and girls. Some of you just grow up as sad-assed adults. But for the rest of us. I'm sure some of you came out of a birthing canal and you were 160 pounds just angry. I protest. What did children have? Innocence. What else?
Honesty.
Honesty. What else?
Playful.
Spontaneous.
Joy.
Predictable. Unpredictable.
Inquisitive.
Inquisitive.
Curious.
And then what do?
We give them parents.
And you know the problem of a parent? Any dysfunction the parent has generally is the dysfunction of the grandparents, dysfunction of the great-grandparents. They keep passing on the dysfunction because everyone's mirroring the mastery of something else, assuming that it was the right thing to do. Think of how many of our parents smoked and drank thinking it was the right thing to do. They mastered that because it was socially acceptable. You went to a party in the 1940s and 50s, as our parents did. You had a drink. You smoked. You ate crappy food. And you talked conservative. Right? And you went home anally retentive and hung yourself up in a closet. So, and anything that was its opposite was threatening. Ooh, those long-haired. Ooh, remember? Just having long hair was such a threat. People got in fights over it. Became a major issue. Hair. Well, what about Christ's hair? What about Buddha's? Well, not Buddha. What about the lack of Buddha? Was something wrong with Buddha? Was he shaving his head? Did he have male pattern baldness? What about Abraham and Isaac? Were they hippies? What about the picture of God or goddess? Long hair. Ooh, a hippie god. Did he do drugs? Did he eat magic mushrooms? Did he skip with Timothy Leary? The journey continues till next week on Master.